Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 108. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week on Anarchist News. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism by email at podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually some good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org. Monstrous flowers. For a long time, I've been bemused by those before and after images of places destroyed by war. You know the ones I'm talking about. Take some timeless image of a beautiful landmark or peaceful neighborhood in Aleppo and then juxtapose it with the same area post-2011, now filled with collapsed buildings and bomb craters. The intent of these images is not dissimilar to the hand-wringing over the destruction of monuments in Palmyra by ISIS in 2015, lamenting the horror of war which lays waste to beauty. Not infrequently, they're also intended as a visual critique of U.S. foreign policy, where the peace of a Syrian, Iraqi, Libyan, etc. street, populated by shoppers and tourists, is destroyed by intervention by the U.S. What piques my interest in these images is how beauty is conflated with peace. The appearance of peace in the street is seen as beautiful and desirable, even more so if we add the additional filter of propaganda that socialists and the occasional anarchist tend to fall for when it comes to our official enemies. How beautiful the streets of Tripoli were, how proud the ancient mosques of Syria before the violence of war. Even now, with Assad's control over Syria expanding and restoring stability, you see reports of a French company working to restore some of the cultural artifacts of the ancient world. The following quote from a Vice article titled, "How Syrians Are Rebuilding the Monuments Destroyed by ISIS," is instructive. Quote, 2 years later, in July of 2017, Aurélien Peyroux, a geometric engineer employed by the small French architecture company Art Graphique and Patrimoine, AGP, was standing by the door of this temple, the biggest in Palmyra, after it had been freed from ISIS control. Its gilded limestone frame leaned precariously, threatening to collapse among the ruins. Flanked by a group of Syrian soldiers for security and armed with a laser scanner, Peyroux watched where he stepped. It's not uncommon for ISIS to line their old strongholds with landmines. Amid the sound of far-off explosions punctuated by gunfire, Peyroux inspected the door from all angles to figure out how to save it from certain collapse. End quote. The beauty, both existent and potential, is immediate in the gilded limestone frame of the freed temple, the violence of the guns and explosions far off, though also threatening in the vengeful ghost of ISIS. The violence of the Syrian soldiers is also far off, the guards here only representing orderly defensive potential violence. The piece of this article is similar to the piece of the aforementioned images, that is, the lack of apparent violence. Regardless of one's thoughts on U.S. interventions, it's well known that the locations from which these images are often drawn were or are also ruled by governments where violence, the brutal, spectacular kind that one sees little of in the U.S., was the norm long before a different kind of violence visited them. One has to wonder how many torture chambers were located in the buildings and beneath the streets where these Halcyon photos were taken. We might also wonder what kind of violence was enacted to raise the temple and its gilded arch. It's this contrast between beauty and violence that's examined by Octave Mirbeau in The Torture Garden, and which comes to mind when I think about those before and after photos. In it, the protagonist is taken on a journey through hell in the form of an immaculately lush garden populated with bodies, quote, violently distorted and subjected to hideous and shameful tortures, unquote. The garden's beauty at its outer edges is slowly corroded by flecks of blood and meat on the flowers, progressing to the point where the flowers and birds menace the viewers, and victims are tortured within the trees themselves. His guide and lover is a woman who, like the garden itself, has a beauty that belies her delight in the tortures that take place there. The central dilemma for the protagonist is his inability to escape from the ugliness he sees in the garden and Clara, and into the beauty he initially perceived in them. Confronted with a beauty inseparable from torture, he attempts to run away into the myths of impenetrable beauty that he no longer believes. Quote, "Alas, the gates of life never swing open except upon death, never open except upon the palaces and gardens of death, and the universe appears to me like an immense, inexorable torture garden, blood everywhere, and, where there is most life, horrible tormentors who dig your flesh, saw your bones, and retract your skin with sinister, joyful faces," unquote. Mirbeau, an anarchist, condemns with his protagonist's revelation appetites, greed, hatred, and lies, social institutions, justice, love, glory, heroism, and religion as, quote, "monstrous flowers and hideous instruments of eternal human suffering, unquote. Things that we may revel and delight in, and even perceive as beautiful, that also punish and torture us, both as believers, and most especially when we attempt to resist or live lives outside of them. We could certainly add peace to that list of monstrous flowers. Those who look at a photo of pre-war Aleppo and only see peace are those who look at the torture garden and only see benign beauty. Look closer and you can see the blood on the streets, the chunks of human flesh hanging from the shop signs. Look closer and you can see the torture that builds and maintains the apparent peace of those photos. The burnt ruins of the after image are just those torture pits bursting into the open. Worse still, some of those revolutionaries would fill those same pits, just with different bodies, blood to water their own monstrous flowers of revolution. One of the central dilemmas presented in the torture garden involves the ethics of beauty. To me, there's a danger in anarchists presenting this world, or one we're fighting for, as beautiful, in that the beauty of this world, say the peaceful city street, in fact hides so many hideous instruments, and may in fact become an instrument of torture in its ideals of peacefulness, community, etc. If we're communicating an ideal of anarchic beauty in the language and images comfortable and familiar to people, we're playing games with existing concepts of beauty that are rife with torture for the sake of winning hearts and minds, while we lose the soul of our ideas. If the question is, can we create a world without torture? I think the answer is no. Even imagining a future with no nation states or capitalism, torture both physical and spiritual will probably continue. But if we accept that torture will exist as a given, at least within our lives, where does that lead us? Mirbeau presents two ways of coping with the torture garden. One, the protagonist's route, is to retreat into an ideal beauty in an effort to escape the ugliness of the torture interwoven with it. The other lies with Clara, who accepts the world as is and revels in the tortures. Neither of these is presented as tenable. The protagonist is only willing himself to lie, and Clara's revelry gives way to pensiveness, bleak introspection, and a retreat into herself as she eventually loses consciousness, a cycle that we're told she repeats endlessly. Bleak as these outcomes are, I can think of people in my life who resemble both of them. For myself, I think we can live lives during which we torture ourselves and each other much less, even if we continue to dwell among the palaces and gardens of death. The least we can do is not to be so taken in by the appearance of beauty, avoiding the static, deceiving images of clean streets and congenial neighbors in our portrayals of something that looks like the beautiful idea. Thank you to a member of the collective for this editorial. What's new this week? Notes on our March 15th from Montreal Counter Info. Notes on the March 15th street actions and suggestions for future ones. Quote, the rear of the demo, the dispersal tactics on Friday and in the election night demo last October, were identical. Riot cops arrive about a block away behind the demo and shoot tear gas. The panic that circulates can allow them to drive vehicles straight into the running crowd, accelerating the dispersal of the gas. What could a combative crew of people holding down the rear of the demo accomplish? No specific proposals to make here, but we think this is an area for improvement. Unquote. More in the comments here as people use ANews to talk to each other, and sometimes themselves.
Two letters from the anarchist comrade in prison since January 29th from Act for Freedom. Two excellent letters from an anarchist in prison in Germany. Quote, the existence of this possibility, i.e. going to prison, is precisely a reason not to make our life outside already a prison. Conventions and prejudices, progressive compromises and fleeting satisfactions, which allow us to get to the next day, leading to constraint and fear that seeks to diminish us in our own eyes. This revolutionary project that each anarchist develops in themselves also continues to develop when one is in prison. Contributing to it and not sacrificing our initiative to the dictates of repression is a revolutionary, not merely anti-repressive and of course human, solidarity that I also feel for anyone who stews in the dungeons of the state. We can sometimes find ourselves paying too much attention to the cops' truncheon in jail. But basically, repression is also the spreading of rituals and symbolic contents that close us up in a cultural ghetto, distracting us from the reality of the social struggle. the offer of participatory solutions in exchange for small concessions, the harassment on all sides by stimuli and information ever more devoid of real significance, language that is emptying itself of meaning, whereas it is what allows us to make our ideas understandable to ourselves and to others, unquote. This prisoner understands many languages, but contact information is not given.
Call for musicians. Hate music, hate fascism, anti-fascist noise compilation for charity. From Heresy Distro. Quote, Heresy Distro's sonic propaganda wing, Black and Green Tapes, is putting out call for our inaugural compilation, Hate Music, Hate Fascism. We're looking for artists producing noise, experimental, drone, dark ambient, power electronics, free improvisation, field recordings, and other related genres with themes of anti-fascism, anti-racism, and anarchism. The release will be put to tape, and 100% of the proceeds will go to Schools for Chiapas, a charity helping to educate children in Zapatista territory in southern Mexico. Unquote.
A sales pitch for the insurrection, a critical look at the coming insurrection. From Leuterhard by Wolfie Landstreicher. Originally published years ago in a journal of Desire Armed, I agree with many of its points, but it does also come across as an old person writing about the new thing. Quote, The Invisible Committee provides an introduction to the American edition entitled A Point of Clarity. It is nearly as empty as the rest of the book, but its first two sentences are obviously intended to catch you and draw you in. Everyone agrees, it's about to explode. Thrills and excitement are bound to follow. But there is more to the first sentence. Everyone agrees is precisely the attitude the Invisible Committee has about everything it has contributed to this book. If you are looking for publicity slogans, for fiery political propaganda, for emotional ultra-left platitudes, it's all here. On the other hand, if you're looking for well-reasoned arguments, well-constructed theoretical analyses, significant examinations and inquiries into the world we face today and how we might confront it, forget it. Arguments are unnecessary because everyone agrees, everyone can testify to, everyone feels, the few necessary truths. Unquote. Darn kids and their lack of rigor.
On the Poverty of Joyful Militancy, from Anon. A snark-heavy review of the book Joyful Militancy that quotes To Our Customers, a book from the Italian critiquing the Invisible Committee, to point out that saying contradictory things is a way to be all things to all people, which ultimately means being nothing to anyone. Another criticism is that the authors are trying to save organizing from itself. Quote, Still, the truth remains. Community organizers are petty politicians. This is not to say they are mean people. They can be quite nice. They also need to be quite nice in order to be effective in their work. To say they are petty politicians is to first point to the scale of their authoritarian ambitions, and second to the problematic nature of their modus operandi. Being an organizer is hard, thankless work that often no one has asked for. This tediousness is cause of great misery, leading to exhaustion or burnout. Obviously, the solution is to end the source of misery, the organizing. Misery for both the organizers and the organized, the governing and the governed, the representatives and the represented, and the represented. In other words, to end militancy altogether. Instead, the authors want to save militancy from itself, in place of liberating themselves from the misery that's militancy. They intend to make work joyful instead of opposing joy to work, to make politics joyful instead of opposing freedom to politics. Unquote. This review is perhaps a few paragraphs too long, but it seems like the author was having fun with it, and who are we to get in the way of that?
Surviving Zimbabwe, an Anarchist Critique, from Zabalaza by Leroy Maisiri. It is entirely unclear to me where the survival comes into this article, which is a fairly standard anarchist refutation of the state-level political situation in Zimbabwe, where two leaders are struggling for power and the international left is confused, if by confused, one means not anarchist. Quote, The problem with explaining Zimbabwe in terms of a few bad leaders at the head of the state is that it reduces the problem to the behavior of a few. It does not examine the system that generates brutal leaders like Mugabe and Mnangagwa, and it cannot explain why the basic system does not change, even when some of the personnel does. It fails to explain why the Zimbabwean state did not change significantly when the opposition movement for democratic change won local elections or with the entry of the MDC into a government of national unity with the ZANU-PF in 2009, unquote. Some weird definition of survival, I guess?
Praying Anarchy from hapax.blog.com, translated by The Collective. A blog entry that is a snapshot of a Japanese anarchism. This very brief piece defends prayer as a type of meditation, a way to achieve a space away from normal hierarchical dominated life. Quote, However, prayer carried out in solitude is a ceaseless interruption of statification, like where theologian Jacques Ellul arrived when he cast aside the simplistic dedication to democracy of the liberal and the lukewarm thinking of Marxists who see capitalism as the supreme enemy. We must be rooted in a praying anarchy. Unquote. It's short!
The Alt Creeps from threewayfight.blogspot.com by Rowan. This is an article from 2017 looking at two books, The Fascist Creep and Control Alt Delete. I resent Rowan for making me appreciate the good parts of Reed Ross's book, perhaps most significantly the acknowledgement that, to paraphrase, shit's confusing. Quote, while Marxist and anarchist leftists have generally understood fascism to be the most authoritarian and violent form of capitalist rule, Reed Ross takes seriously fascism's radical, even revolutionary, opposition to capitalist modernity. Unquote. Rowan then speaks to the book's failures, which I recognize from having read just a chapter of it. Quote, however, Reed Ross does tend to define every social, political, cultural, or spiritual trend he doesn't like as being fascist, or at least tainted by it. In identifying a fascist creep, he is too quick to resort to a casual guilt by association and a constant search for enemies, mistaking a moralist purity for the kind of political clarity we need to fight and win. Unquote. Rowan's thoughts on Control-Alt-Delete make it sound like a worthwhile partner to, or substitute for, the better-known kill-all-normies.
Transnational decolonization is the solution, not movements as Bernie Sanders's and the Women's March. From theanarchistlibrary.org by Mohamed Jean Venues. Bad writing, but despite the misdirection of the title, plenty of interesting ideas, including comparing the bonding of capital and state to a normative nuclear family with the state as dad and capitalism as mom. Also, quote, not understanding the difference between fascism and totalitarianism is not just a passé, mute, theoretical point, but rather one that possesses destructive, crippling social movement consequences as well, especially when considering what constitutes resistance. This is the heavy price of living in an Orwellian, post-alternative fact and schizophrenic world of doublespeak, informed and tainted by the destructive legacy of liberalism and its dilution of our words and their meanings. While in modernity, white supremacist tendencies and assumptions overtly inform conservative right-wing parties and positions, the greater danger is how they covertly and underhandedly disguise themselves within neoliberal, progressive, and even leftist positions, unquote. There's enough in this piece, most of it unexplored or undefended, to make several more careful and perhaps more compelling pieces, but it's a great provocation.
Communes and Land Projects, a nomadic critique of communization by Zechev. A blog post challenging the anarchist and other tendency to settle down away from cities as an exercise in colonization and a left-handed defense of nomadism as the only correct/anarchist way to live. Mixing reflections on violence in with references to Taz and deeper meanings of terminology, this is a young man combining an attempt to be convincing with explaining himself and also figuring out what he thinks. Modern life.
Putting Ideas on Trial, the Greek State's Laboratory of Repression, from CrimeThink. With commentary from CrimeThink, this is mostly a translated interview from a Greek anarchist newspaper, which is unusual and remarkable in its own right, as such projects in Greece are very few. The interviewee is Greek anarchist prisoner Nikos Romanos. Quote, sentenced to 15 years and 10 months in prison in 2014 after police arrested and brutally tortured him for expropriating a bank in Benevento, Kosani. They also accused him and five others of participating in an alleged terrorist organization, Conspiracy Cells of Fire. All of the accused deny this. Unquote. Here, Romanos talks about the 187A law, a new tactic by the state to declare anarchism itself illegal, which honestly seems appropriate. Aren't anarchists internal enemies? Romanos encourages the creation of a more effective, subversive movement.
Anarchist Days, Jornadas Anarquistas 2019, from Anarquismo. A defense of organization in the name of especifismo. Quote, we live life in insertion, but it is necessary to complement it with the political organization, that small engine that pushes the popular movement. The anarchist political organization, according to the especifista conception, is not a vanguard, but militant abnegation with the purpose of encouraging and guiding a process of revolutionary rupture with the widespread participation of the organized people, unquote. Perhaps someone should arrange a bulk drop of Manual for Revolutionary Readers for some of these anarchists. I guess it would have to be translated first.
For Irish Freedom and Working Class Power, from Anon, by David Van Dusen. This is an example of the comments being far more interesting than the class-centric pro-IRA story. The question of anarchist support of / inclusion in struggles that are labeled with nation names is a continuing issue, since it could be and or is a matter of terminology in some cases, but not in other cases, and sometimes a lack of real-world experience going up against non-anarchist goals. Lots of people, mostly, but not always, talking past each other. Do anarchists only support anarchist projects? What does it mean to support people, even partially, who we don't agree with, versus to be purist isolationists?
Anarchic Movement, Ambulations in Thought, after Steve Paxton from Autonomies. This is a reflection on, and a series of four videos about, an improv dancer and teacher named Steve Paxton, who is still angry after all these years. From the reflections, quote, "Let us imagine political movements as without beginnings or ends, as eruptions into the scripted and choreographed time-space of governed history societies. Let us accept that they have no center, and that they should not have any center if they are to remain movements, escaping capture and apparatuses of control. The singularity of any movement will be created in and through the movement. Indeed, the movement is its very singularity. Should a movement gain life, its plurality of expressions will lead it in a multiplicity of directions. These may cohere, express a structure, momentarily, or for the duration, or not. But should they do so, it will be a unity in movement, a unity constituted through gestures of decentering and recentering, which is the very meaning of autonomy," unquote.
In Memoriam, Joffrey Stewart. From hardcrackers.com by Max G. Bernard. A touching and inspiring eulogy of an anarchist pacifist from a time even before Chisel. Quote, "He was an early participant in the Beat Movement. He was barred from the Roosevelt University building at one point because as a speaker at a student organization program, he burned an American, an Israeli, and a UN flag to signify his rejection of government. And a number of student groups subsequently made it almost a point of honor to invite him to speak at least once a year to defy the ban." Unquote. And the A-News comment section again proves itself, this time with the addition of another friend of Stewart's, who weighs in to amend some storytelling and adds some memories about this longtime stalwart.
Police and Ethnography, from CrimeThink. This is a picture book of police activity with sarcastic captions, because apparently some of the people CrimeThink wants to talk to have questions about uniform police. Last week we talked about CrimeThink as a 101 project, so I'm not sure what to say about this. Anarchist kindergarten? Wake me up when they get to the cops in the head conversation.
Audio and video. Bad News, March 2019, number 20, 31 minutes. Quote, "This month, we're excited to share with you the following angry voices. One, Dissident Island Radio from London, UK, will be sharing a roundup of this last month's news of interest to anarchists from around the UK. Two, comrades from the self-organized independent radio station 105 FM of Mytilene, the capital of Lesbos Island, will be updating on struggles and actions in the Aegean Sea region of Greece. Three, A Radio Berlin shares an interview with Michael Prutz of the initiative Deutsche Wohnen und Co. Eintegnen, which translates roughly as expropriate housing corporations and semi-socializing the difficult Berlin housing market. And four, Chernia Luknia, who interviewed self-organized anarchist women in Turkey affiliated with DAF," unquote.
Anarchy Radio, March 19th, 2019, always an hour. Kathin, of the name that every caller mispronounces, co-hosts this week. The two hosts take turns depressing each other and chuckling sadly about it. There are two calls, both of them decent, one about how people of color could best respond to the current situation, the other about Jay-Z's understanding of the significance of fire and Rhea's respectful disagreement with him.
Anarchy Bang, Episode 12, Art. Quote, "This week we will look into the anarchist relationship with art in both its visual and conceptual modes. Art can be in natural affinity with the anarchist impulse and often overlaps with radical politics directly, that is, until it gets recuperated. How helpful are critiques of revolution, utopia, and specialization for anarchists when considering art? How would a more aestheticized approach be valuable to us? Are artists self-creating individuals, merely workers, or something else? What kind of art inspires us to create new worlds? In what ways does art reinforce the ideology of the world we want to destroy?" Unquote.
Topic of the week, how do you use your cyberspace? It's no surprise that anarchists would reject the internet entirely as being used for liberatory purposes. After all, it started out as ARPANET by the military, with the obvious intent of further dominating their territory as well as U.S.-controlled locations abroad. This ended up working perfectly as a business model as well as late capitalism, with the internet becoming a giant data collection scheme. However, many caught on to how easily they could subvert these purposes for distributing free entertainment, encrypt their communications, and find even crazier outlets for countercultural activities. Part of the reason I use the internet is that it allows me to avoid cable television with the constant flux of ads and ridiculous propaganda. This is not to say that it hasn't caused problems for me. To me, the internet has largely been an experiment with how I would like to better interact with it. How has the internet aided your desire to be free of authority? Has it aided you in this purpose? How have you changed your internet habits to suit this purpose? And Anarchist News would like to thank the person who submitted this, because this was a guest topic of the week.
Yeah, so it's interesting. The question has the potential to be really interesting. I hate the way in which it was framed finally as how has the internet aided your desire to be free of authority? I mean, the answer to that is it has not in any way, shape, or form. That's absurd. But that takes me in this way of like a lot of the central anarchist questions, and especially how they're framed when you're a younger anarchist, tend to be these big, expansive, hopeful, dreamful questions that, you know, sadly over time, it's hard not to answer, like, you know, the way in which you frame that is absurd. But okay, with that said, the internet taught me about how I could implement my vision into the world. I mean, you know, my skill, talent, effectiveness in the anarchist world over the past 20 years has entirely been because of being facile with internet technologies, you know, starting with HTML and a little Apache and, you know, moving on to other things. And, even the way in which we use podcasts, we, meaning, you know, Anarchist News and Little Black Kurt, I mean, all that is a consequence of this thing called the internet. But free of authority, not quite.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that general sentiment because I think even the way that the question is framed, how do you use your cyberspace? I mean, saying that it's mine is a little complicated, I think. But I felt a lot of affinity with this person who I imagine am probably around this person's age. In the sense that I see, like, I mean, I would not call this being free of authority, but seeing things like file sharing or whatever niche cultures on the internet, those are things that I can definitely, I associate with on a daily basis. And also feel, yeah, I felt I heard my voice in this too.
Yeah. It's funny, the little take on subculture. You know, I'm very much thinking too much about subculture lately, and the way in which the internet has both sort of like democratized subculture and destroyed it.
Go on, tell me about that.
Well, I've been talking about it for podcasts for the past month or so, but essentially, you know, I mean, the easiest example is to talk about punk rock and the way in which, you know, back when I was a kid, I found punk rock through tape trading and through social interactions with human beings who would talk to me and, you know, pass me a tape. And, you know, I never had the money to buy and discover this material on my own. But, and, you know, and it took years and years and years of really loving, you know, certain bands and certain approaches and certain attitudes, but always in relationship to people. And nowadays, you know, literally a weekend in Wikipedia, and most any young person can learn pretty much 80% of what I know in a weekend.
Sure.
But of course.
Yeah, no.
But of course, it ends up being a kind of empty knowledge.
Sure. No, absolutely true. And I would imagine that most people who have a more than passing interest in punk rock now have music libraries on their computer that are way bigger than anything you could have imagined when you were tape trading, but for also sure. have far thinner connections with the people who they actually got that from.
Yeah. I mean, actually, just to talk about the internet as a filter of how you access information, you know, it's very bizarre for me, but of course I know that it's a dominant phenomenon right now. For younger people who consume music, they primarily do it through something like Spotify or Pandora, which means that many of them don't actually own any music at all. They just stream it. They just type it in or you know, demand it at the moment. That is such an absolutely different relationship to how one would, you know, to how I ever have engaged in music.
Sure.
I mean, even though I'm slightly too young to have been into like Deep Purple or like Pink Floyd or something, I mean, I still listen to albums.
Sure.
Like when that's, I said
that's novel.
Right. I mean, the idea that that's novel is like crazy, right? I mean, that really was a generational shift.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think that like the question of culture here comes up to me because it's, I mean, what constitutes a culture is a big question in this. And obviously the way that a lot of the internet is designed, using an example like Spotify, it's designed for you, the individual. And, you know, of course you can recommend songs, and it's way easier to get people into music that you like now than it was before, I think. But also a lot of these spaces exist as things that cater to you, the individual, and not really encouraging a lot of sociability even within that space.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I guess that speaks to the how do you use your cyberspace. Every aspect of my life, and I think this is true of most people, has been touched by the existence of the internet. And you know, like the idea that I don't have a television in my front room, but I do have a screen, and the screen can access either, you know, downloadable file technologies or streaming technologies. And I think that this is very common. Like most people have a similar sort of setup.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. And I mean, also way more screens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I recently decommissioned my dual screens at my desk, but that was because at that point I was actually having three screens at my desk and now I just have two. You know? but I'm also responding to this, you know, to the stupid phone and you know, so yeah, I mean, the number of screens we all have in our lives now is just ridiculous.
Sure. Yeah, I guess something that I thought of when I read this article, this question was that actually a lot of my use of the internet is very mundane. And I mean, there was a time when I was very like, file sharing is really important as practice online. It's been a long time. And, you know, I think that there is still a very like, I mean, whatever, it's a very mundane way of saying like, oh yeah, like I like the fact that I can give files to people who, even if I don't have any personal connection with them, I'm giving them access. And this is also illegal. isn't the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, mostly the way in which it's like file sharing is one of those times where you see the economic questions really integrated into the rest of this. I find it amazing that streaming video has basically like largely decimated file sharing culture. Like fuck, yeah. Like that just blows my mind. But you know, the economics just have made it true.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, that's like, it is kind of wild because it seems like such a, to me, I find that odd too. And it's funny because my partner is kind of critically fascinated with the fact that I still download music at all. Because she gets her music from Spotify, and you know, she has access with Spotify to a whole way more music than I would if I just drew it all on my phone. But it's also one of those things where, like, what I come back with is, like, coming from a place of course I want the files, because this gives me some kind of independence where I'm not paying for Spotify, and also, like, I have access to them, so that if they get taken off of Spotify, or I want to put them on something else, I have them.
Well, you know, the other part of this that kind of is amusing to me is that in file sharing culture, you know, there's a certain pressure towards high quality MP3s. Now, you know, as we know, the nature of an MP3 being a reasonable size, and the whole rise of iPod type technology, you know, 10 years ago, is all about the compression and losing data. So nowadays, when you try to download files, there's this real inclination towards downloading FLAC files. But FLAC files are much, much larger, FLAC being a lossless technology. But and so it's like, and about 5 years ago, or maybe even closer to 10, I made the mistake of converting a big chunk of my music collection to OGG. but basically this becomes a chore in the way that Spotify is absolutely not, right? Spotify is just about getting the thing you want instantly. And anyways, so because of I fucked up 10 years ago and went the OGG direction, like, I avoid the FLAC files like crazy. But also because I can't tell the difference, you know, between a FLAC file and a 192 MP3. Anyways.
Sure. Yeah, no, I feel that. And I mean, this gets also into questions of proprietary, your phone and your, well, particularly I think of my phone, like, most phones aren't going to be able to play FLAC files. And, and that's like, I mean, I sometimes download FLAC files because I think I can hear the difference, but it's complicated. I mean, you know, that's something that I think usually gets said by nerds who are like, of course you can hear the difference, whatever. But it's complicated because, again, this gets back to, like, what is my cyberspace? I don't control what my phone can play.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like the fact that we introduced late into this conversation the phenomena of your phone as your primary internet device, that is a huge mindfuck. Like, for me, phones are not computing devices. I use it. I have Signal. I listen to podcasts via the phone and not my computer. But, like, I don't touch the phone most days. Whereas I think you probably use 75%, if not more, of your computing is via your phone.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little less than that, just because, I mean, I do have a desktop, which is also something that is, like, I think kind of fascinating to people who are younger. But I think, I do definitely use my phone a lot, and part of that is due to my job, and I work for a subcontractor for Google, and so part of my job is using their product on my phone and improving it, and so I've gotten like a lot of that has been normalized.
The point with the phone is that, you know, when we talk about proprietary technologies, the phone is entirely a lockbox. You know, it's extremely difficult to run, like, a different ISO on your phone. You can do it, but it's extremely difficult. But when I say lockbox, I mean the fact that, you know, you can't crack it open and improve it. You know, you're basically married to some bullshit company who probably has you under some sort of, like, multi-year contract, and all of that is just, you know, terrible nonsense. Which isn't to say that it can be avoided, but it's just, you know, to recognize that, like, openness is pretty important when it comes to technologies, and it's worth mentioning that phones are the opposite of open.
Of course. And I mean, I think this gets into another question or another thought that I had when I read this topic of the week, which is, the concept of the internet, specifically like Web 2.0, a lot of spaces that, whatever, the countercultural activities that are mentioned exist in are within these spaces where you are, in fact, not, you are a subject to the whims of the people who own that space, be it Tumblr, be it Reddit.
Sure. You are, in fact, not free.
Absolutely. And as just for a recent example, Tumblr recently banned all adult material, visual material, as of December of last year.
Yeah.
And this meant that a whole bunch of just tiny, whatever, fetish communities and just like other people who made up a significant portion of their user base, they lost like a third of their users after this. But, you know, they just basically just kicked them all out. And that, I think, shows how precarious a lot of that existence is within most of what exists as the internet.
Yeah. I mean, this is really part of the conversation that, you know, that people have sort of stopped talking about for a long time. But like, whatever other criticisms you might have of Anarchist News, it is in fact an open platform that's been active for, you know, now 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for this conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lino Mabel. What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by a member of the collective. We thank Aragorn and Friend for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. For news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, see you at anarchistnews.org and or the Anarchist News IRC chat room linked on ANews.